Oh, such a good question.
Well, when you come with these questions, that's another great branding question.
That's a big question.
That's a very interesting question because it really makes you think about what you just did.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
And welcome back to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This is Ben Baker. Thank you all for coming back to the show week after week. You're an amazing audience. You guys are just passionate, and I love the passion of my audience. You guys are great. You guys leave comments. You guys email me. And you give me great advice, and you tell me who you want to listen to and what I can do better. And I love that about my audience. This week, we have Jonathan Goldson from Ethical Imperatives on the show. It is going to be a great conversation. We're going to talk about relationships and how COVID has changed how we engage and trust each other. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I was so excited. I heard you on my friend Deb Coviello's show. I guess it was about a month ago. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I love the conversation that the two of you had. So shout out to Deb. You know, she's been a guest on my show. I've been a guest on her show. But I love, you know, when I hear a great guest, when I hear somebody that was insightful, when I hear somebody that's interesting, I love sitting there going, wait a second here. I got to get them on my show. And we got to have a conversation because that's what it's all about. It's finding interesting people and talking about interesting things. And, you know, your reason for being, where you're coming from, where you are, is the whole ethical imperative. So why don't you tell my audience a little bit about you, where you came from, where you are, where you're going, and then we can get into the topic.
Well, where I came from is relatively easy. Where I'm going is a little more complicated, but I like to start with my college career. I studied English at the University of California. And what does one do with a degree in English? You could do what I did. I don't necessarily recommend it. I put on a backpack and went hitchhiking across the United States for half a year.
Perfect.
Yeah. And after that, across the Atlantic, went backpacking across Europe. And after a year of traveling, I ended up in Israel, where through an unlikely series of events, I reconnected with my Jewish roots. Although reconnected isn't quite the right word, because I grew up with really no knowledge whatsoever of Judaism, what it meant, or what it was all about. And I discovered something I never would have expected, this vibrant culture of deep thought and profound ideas and meaning and purpose, and changed the whole trajectory of my life. I ended up living in Israel for 9 years, met my wife, had her first two children, eventually earned my rabbinic degree, became an Orthodox rabbi. And then I embarked on my high school teaching career, teaching young people the wisdom that I had studied and learned and wanted to give them a means of recognizing how to find direction and purpose in their lives. So I taught for 1 year in Budapest, Hungary, taught for 2 years in Atlanta, Georgia, and 20 years in St. Louis, where I am now, and I retired in 2016. And that's when I started my business as a professional speaker, trainer, and coach, trying to communicate the 3,000 years of Jewish wisdom to a broader secular audience, take those universal values and impart to professionals why good ethics is good business and the benefits of intellectual integrity. And so the speaking business took quite a hit, like many people have under COVID.
Absolutely.
Like a lot of people, I'm trying to figure out how to adapt to the virtual world. And that's part of what we're doing here right now.
Well, I want to get back into it. I love this, the comment, good ethics is good business. And let's stick a pin on that for a second and really come back to that. But I want to talk about your time hitchhiking, because here is something that almost no one does anymore, you know, for a lot of very different
for good reason. Yeah.
Yeah. For a lot of different reasons, safety reasons. It's just not something that's really done anymore. So I want to find out, what was the biggest insights you learned by being in a place where you are completely and totally at somebody else's mercy? You stand by the side of the road, you put your thumb out, and you're going to go as far as the next person's going to, you know, you take you and you go from there. So what were the things that you learned about yourself that, you know, that allowed you, because, you know, that's an explorer mentality, you know, and that, to me, that's an explorer mentality. So what are the things you learned about yourself by doing that?
I have two big takeaways. And interestingly, one of them I only came to this summer as I was reconfiguring my keynote for a virtual platform. And this idea that I sort of knew, but it crystallized. And it goes to my first day hitchhiking. I had taken a train from Palm Springs, California to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I got up the next morning and went out on the road and stood there and stood there and stood there. And an hour went by, lots of cars went by. And I started to wonder, is this really gonna happen? And then I had a brainwave. I reached in my backpack, I took out a notebook and a pen, and in big block letters, I wrote one word, Denver. And within a few minutes, a car pulled over, driver invited me in, and I settled into the passenger seat. And he turned to me and he said, I've never picked up a hitchhiker in my life. He said, but I'm going to Denver. And I saw your sign, and I thought I should pick him up, give him a ride. And the lesson that I learned from that is that when you have a destination, it gives you credibility. It projects a sense of purpose and direction and trust. You're not just floating. You're not just wandering aimlessly. And also, when you have a destination that someone else sees your destination, wants to go there, they'll want to go with you. Because we like traveling together. We like alliances and partnerships and camaraderie. And it's better to go on a journey with someone than to go on a journey by yourself. So that sense of destination and purpose is one that really, it's interesting. It took me so long to really crystallize that thought. But I think particularly nowadays, when, you know, where there is so much distraction in our lives, and we have this sense of so many opportunities and so many possibilities and potential. You know, potential is a wonderful thing if we actually do something with it. But there's a feeling that if I commit myself to a particular course of action or particular goal, well, now I'm eliminating other options. And by eliminating other options, I'm giving up, I'm relinquishing that potential. And so we hold on to the potential and we end up not achieving, because we don't want to make the commitment. And that's a profound mistake, because ultimately it's the commitment and the sense of purpose that gives meaning and ultimately happiness to our lives.
It's interesting, because I heard that put, it's so profound. First of all, it is. It's extremely profound. I heard that put the other day, fear of a better option. You know, they call it FOBO. It's by the same guy, and I can't remember what his name is, that it's coined the term FOMO, the fear of missing out, the fear of a better option. So FOBO, where we're so worried about, is there going to be a better option? What's next? There's so many possibilities in front of me, so I do nothing. You know, you're so worried about that if I do this, I might not get to do that. And I think you're right. We all need to pick a direction. We all need to commit and, you know, go all in. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And then you learn from that and you move forward. But I think that we all need to sit there and say, yes, there is a multitude, millions of options in front of us, but we can't do everything.
Yeah, I actually just posted a meme on this yesterday from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who just passed away a month ago. Really extraordinary individual. But he said, we're living in a time of maximum choice and minimum meaning. And I think about it. I go into a department store to buy a toothbrush, and it's almost paralyzing. A whole wall of options. And
that's just the Colgate, or that's just, yeah, the Crest.
Exactly.
Never mind Colgate versus Crest versus whatever. It's just like, if you just go look at the Crest aisle, there's 32 different options.
Yeah, or, you know, 36 varieties of Ragu spaghetti sauce. You know, has anybody actually tried them all? And if you did, could you remember which one you liked and which one you didn't? I mean, it's, choices are great when they mean something, but choices that are so, you know, really irrelevant or so trivial. And then there's a sense, well, whatever which one I'm choose, that means there are 35 varieties I haven't chosen. And what might I be missing out on? So we don't enjoy the choices we make because we're too concerned with the ones that we've passed up.
Well, it's the restaurant that has pages and pages and pages and pages of options.
Exactly.
And you watch the average person who's never been to that restaurant before, and they're paralyzed. And they keep on going. You can watch them, and they're constantly going to the waiter, just give me another 5 minutes. Just give me another 5 minutes. Because there are so many different choices, you know, that they just don't know where to go. But, you know, when I walk into, say, a restaurant, and I've been there 50 times before, I'll have a number four. You know, I know, yeah, there might be 30 other things that I'm going to choose, but I'm always going to have a number four because I always have a number four. And that may be comforting because you know you've picked something, you're going to go with it. But on the other hand, and that might be something to discuss, you know, are you limiting yourself? You know, if you crawl into being a creature of habit and not being willing to try new things every once in a while, are you also putting yourself at a disadvantage in life?
Of course, this is the paradox of being human, that we're constantly shifting back and forth between these opposites. And in this context, it's the opposite of the familiarity, the security of the familiar, versus expanding our horizons through experimentation. And really, we should be doing both. Because, you know, if you want to extend it into, our political differences, you know, conservatives tend to be more focused on tradition and establishment, and liberal-minded people are more focused on novelty and exploration and potential and possibility. And the problem that we're facing in a society is that we're not talking to each other anymore. We don't trust each other anymore. So liberals only associate with liberals, and conservatives only associate with conservatives, and conservatism can slip into reactionaryism, and liberalism can mutate into irrational utopianism. We're supposed to be engaging with each other because both philosophies are sound and both philosophies are necessary. But it's only a healthy society when there is an engagement, when there's an interaction, when you have the constructive disagreement that comes from actually talking out, hashing out, listening to the other side, understanding where they're coming from, formulating a response, recognizing why somebody believes differently, and recognizing where you can find common ground. And you know what? Every once in a while, gee, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I should re-examine my own beliefs and points of view.
Well, we are all stronger together. I mean, that's where the whole discourse of debate came from. You know, debate came from, I have my point of view, you have your point of view. But when we can discuss it, when we can engage each other, when we can try to understand each other, we may not change each other's point of view, but we may be able to come to a common ground that is going to be better for all of us. And I think that is, you know, something, whether it's politics, whether it's business, whether it's, you know, personal relationships, is becoming less and less of the norm of people actually sitting down and trying to understand each other instead of being so rooted in their own beliefs that they have this ultimate belief that my idea is ultimately right and therefore their idea is ultimately wrong. And I think that's the challenge of society that we truly need to overcome.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is very much the topic of my TED talk, which is about what I call ethical communication. And you asked me about the takeaways from hitchhiking. The story that I tell there is that when I discovered that when you get into a passenger seat of a car, that you have the opportunity to pay for your ride, not in money, but by being of service to the driver. And what many drivers want is someone to listen.
They want company. They want somebody who's be an ear that they didn't have.
Strangers on a Train principle. I've had drivers tell me more than once that they were sharing things with me. They never told their wives or their best friends or their parents or their kids because they knew they were going to see me again and they could unburden themselves. And I realized that my job was to listen, was not to respond or tell my story or rebut or just to let them have that opportunity. And because I wasn't thinking about what I was going to say in response, I ended up paying more attention. Because, you know, most of our conversations or what my college psychology professor called dialogues of the deaf. If you're ever, you know, I used to ride buses a lot or sit in airports, and you could hear people's conversations going on around you. And they're not really talking to each other.
They're talking at each other.
At each other and leapfrogging over one another. And it looks like they're having a conversation, but there's no real exchange of ideas. And when you stop and actually listen, you understand people. And when you understand the people around you, you understand yourself better. And this is how communities form, and this is how relationships form. And without that kind of conversation, then we're really just all living in isolation.
Well, that's the one thing that podcasting has made me better at. It's made me a better listener, because if I'm just waiting to interject with my next question, oh, I got my next question, I'm going to give them the zinger, I'm missing 65 or 70% of what you're actually saying, because I'm so focused about what I'm going to ask you next that I haven't really heard what you just said. But if I sit there and ends up being a conversation, and my responses come naturally out of the question, you know, the conversation that we're having, I find it elevates our conversation. I find it makes, you know, every podcast better. It's not just mine. Most of the podcasters I've ever listened to are phenomenal listeners. And I find it's a skill I'm working on daily to make myself better, because you can always be a better listener. You can always be more intent. You can always listen more critically to be able to think a little bit more about what is the person really saying, not just the words out of their mouth, but what's the ideas that's behind it. So I love that thought process.
Yeah. From the other side, I mean, I've been on about 80 podcasts in the last 2 years. And sometimes when the host will, you know, dig into what I've said, they'll end up drawing out from me a deeper explanation than I had previously been able to articulate. So I've actually come to understand my own subject of expertise better because of a host who followed up on a question, asked an insightful follow-up, and gave me the opportunity to think through my own ideas and articulate them in a new way that yielded new understanding.
So what would be an example of that? Let's dive into that, because that's an interesting thing. And that really comes down to, you know, our initial point. How do we engage and trust each other? Is what are the things, you know, where you've had those aha moments where you've sat there and go, wait a second here, I never really truly knew about myself. What's the one thing that over the last 2 years, over these 80 conversations, has given you insights that have made you better at what you do?
It's really a question of articulating the same idea in a more concise or a more effective way. One of the lines I use in talking about ethics, or the lines I have used, is that compliance is often the enemy of ethics. Because when you try to legislate ethical behavior, what you do is you short circuit the ethical mindset, which is our willingness to look at choices that we're going to make and evaluate them, not based on what can I do or what can I get away with, but what's the right thing to do. And so I was on a show with Diane Helbig in the course of the conversation. What came out was that ethics begins where compliance ends.
Isn't that interesting? Okay. Explain.
Well, it's really saying the same thing. It's just phrasing it, I think, in a more tangible or a more, and maybe even a more positive way than I had said it before. You know, saying that compliance is the enemy of ethics. Okay, so that's a problem. Ethics begins where compliance ends, as we have the rules of compliance, but that's meant to be a guide, not an excuse, but a foundation on which we can build a structure of ethical decision-making. And so to see compliance as a starting point rather than an end point is critical to creating an ethical culture in one's business, and then by extension into one's community, one's family, and every aspect of our lives.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. compliance, and when I think of compliance and when I think of business, I have this flashback to working for a company and going through ISO 9000 compliance 25 or 30 years ago. And the joke was, we could have somebody die on the floor of the warehouse, but as long as we filled the paperwork out properly, we were still going to get our ISO compliance. And that was the joke that was running through the thing, is it seemed more about checking a box and making sure your paperwork was in order than making sure that people were truly safe. And, you know, and that's a really good place to start the conversation, where you were talking about the business of ethics or the ethics of business. Is that enough? Or, you know, is that just the first tick of the box to be able to have a business where we truly take care of the people, both inside the company, the people that engage with the company, the people who sell to the company? And what are the things that we as businesses should we be obligated to do, not from a financial point of view, but from a moral point of view, to make sure that people are taken care of within engaging with our operation?
Well, your question's really the answer. You know, if managers, if administrators, if bosses and CEOs ask themselves that question, then they're on the right track. If they're not asking the questions because they're in compliance, then you got a problem. I mean, in my ethics keynote, I tell the story of Paul O'Neill, who was the CEO of Alcoa, and he later became Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush.
Right.
He took over in 1987, and the company was in a terrible state. Energy prices and labor costs and the sluggish economy and smaller, more nimble companies were gobbling up market share. And his first day as CEO, he announced his grand plan to save the company by making his number one priority worker safety. And the moment he finished speaking, the investors stampeded out of the room. One of them called his 20 biggest clients and said, "The board put some crazy hippie in charge. He's going to kill the company. Sell everything." And he later said this is the worst piece of advice he gave in his entire career, because a year later, Alcoa's profits hit an all-time high.
Right.
So how? Because Paul O'Neill took responsibility for tracking days lost to injury by telling his executive board that they were responsible when a worker was killed repairing a piece of machinery. He put out suggestion boxes throughout every plant asking for employees to report safety hazards. And what they did, the company spent $3 million in 2 months to fix potential problems. So what happened next? So employees started offering suggestions, not just about safety, but about all areas of operations, because they saw that the company was responding to the suggestions. And so they felt empowered to contribute their ideas. And so from 1987 to 1999, under Paul O'Neill, Alcoa Aluminum increased in market value 900%. And net income increased over 750%, because Paul O'Neill demonstrated that he was looking out for his employees. And so they took responsibility to look out for the company. And I like to quote the study by the Trust Edge Leadership Institute that asked employees what they want most from a job. And the number one answer they gave is a boss we can trust. So how do you become a trusted boss? Not by ticking boxes, but by creating a culture that projects concern. You see your employees as partners, not as assets. You're concerned for their well-being. You create an environment in which people feel appreciated and therefore appreciate the opportunity they have to contribute to the company. That's the way you build a successful enterprise.
Yeah, I love that. I love that story. I mean, when I teach leadership training, the thing that I teach people is you have to truly listen to people. You have to understand what their value is, and you have to compel them to engage. You know, it's all about how do you motivate people on their own thing. And when people feel listened to, understood, and valued, it's amazing what they will walk over coals to do for a company. You know, when they feel that they're being taken care of by the company, when they feel that the company is actually working for their best interest and they're not just a number on a spreadsheet that can be replaced at any given time. It's amazing how people will step up and say, wait a second here, we could do this better. Or if we change this, if we move this line around a little better, we could get another 30%, you know, out of this production line. But if nobody ever asks these people what they think, they're never going to say anything because they don't think that they matter. And I love what you're saying about that is, how do we teach leaders to care? How do we teach leaders to, you know, understand that they need to develop trust? Because it sounds so simple, but it's not. It's one of the hardest things leaders are ever going to do in their life is learn how to care about people or learn how to develop trust. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a question I've been grappling with for a long time on many levels. I mean, when I taught high school, how do you get students to care? I mean, I can offer them the most interesting, compelling, valuable ideas. And if they're not receptive, it doesn't make a difference. It's not going to go in. It's not going to penetrate. And it's when you're dealing with CEOs, you would hope that there is a little more interest in understanding those ideas. But I think that the starting point has to be, and what I said in the beginning, is that good ethics is good business. And you know, the data on this is compelling. When you have, when you look at the companies that are ranked highest for a culture of ethics, culture of trust, you see that individuals in that company, they are more productive, they're more engaged, they're more aligned with the sense of company's sense of purpose, they're more connected with their colleagues, they're less prone to burnout, and companies grow faster and more steadily over time. I mean, every rubric tells you that you're going to have a more successful company. The problem is that as human beings, we are, again, creatures of contradiction, creatures of paradox. Our short-term interests are often at odds with our long-term goals and long-term values. And so the whole idea, I mean, Simon Sinek talks about this at great length, the damage done by quarterly reports, because you know, you've got to hit this benchmark. And if you hit it, you're successful. And if you miss it, you're unsuccessful. Well, what if you're on a trajectory that you're not going to hit it now, but you're going to exceed it 6 months from now? But you're so fixated on the quarterly returns that you short-circuit your long-term success by artificially creating some kind of short-term accomplishment. It doesn't make any sense, because we should be in this for the long game. But there are all these pressures, whether you're stockholders and your stock value and your reports. I mean, how many times do you hear reports that such and such company fell 10% on the stock market because they projected earnings that were going to be short of those they had previously projected? I mean, it's madness.
Yeah, they could have missed it by, you know, pennies on the dollar.
Exactly.
You know, quarters of pennies on the dollar. And they just get brutally, you know, killed in the stock market.
Right. So the pressure to meet those benchmarks ends up wiping out the long-term vision and really the common sense that any enterprise it should be focused on sustained, measured growth, because you know we're in this for the long game.
So do you think as companies grow and they go from being public, private to public, and they become more beholden on their stockholders, do you think that the ethical dilemma becomes more and more diversified? Is that people are less ethical or less willing to look at the ethical ramifications of business as they become more beholden on a stockholder versus you know, the employees and the customers that they originally served?
I think that's certainly a real concern. I don't claim to have the business expertise to dissect the dynamics of all the different factors, but the more pressure there is to meet some sort of artificial standard or measure of success, then the more pressure is to do whatever you need to do to get there.
Well, calling all PhDs, you know, if you're looking for a dissertation, there you go. And I'd love to read it. I'd love to read the dissertation. So if anybody wants to take me up and do a dissertation on this, that I think that would be absolutely phenomenal to read.
Yeah. And, you know, but the general principles, whether they apply to a massive corporation, whether they apply to a small business, whether they apply to politics or communities or our relationships with our friends and family. You know, we're living in a time right now where the dynamics of our interactions are so different from what they have been that we have to continuously recalibrate. You know, what is it? You know, I mean, there's a phenomenon which makes my blood boil, ghosting. I mean, I've had interactions that I just cannot wrap my head around. You know, I'll have a conversation with somebody, we'll agree on a path forward, and then nothing. No response to emails, no response to phone calls. I mean, what is so difficult about telling somebody, you know, I think even though we had a good conversation, I just don't see that I'm going to be able to follow up the way we wanted to. I'm going to go in a different direction.
Thank you for your time, but
I mean, why are you wasting my time making me come after you, trying to find you? And why can't you show the simple, common courtesy of being communicative? I mean, I guess people are embarrassed or I don't know. It really baffles me.
I just wrote an article on that. It's called We Need to Learn How to Say No. You know, I just wrote that for an article. I think it was for Carol Roth. You know, but you're right. It's a fascinating dilemma that people are so afraid to disappoint or be controversial or to put themselves out there where they might get hurt, that it's easier for them just to walk away and pretend the conversation never happened than to say thank you, but no thank you.
Yeah, and you can get away with it in a virtual world.
Yes.
You simply don't engage. But is that really the way we want to treat each other? Is that the way we want others to treat us? And you're really cutting yourself off because maybe a year from now, things are going to look different. And now you're going to be afraid to go back to the person because, oh, after the way I treated them last time, why are they going to want to have anything to do with me now?
And therein is the dilemma. Therein is the dilemma of business and ethics and humanity and how it all rolls up into trust. Is that how do we trust somebody who's ghosted us? How do we trust somebody that doesn't stand up, say what they mean what they say, and take responsibility for their actions?
Yeah, and that's very much my definition of ethics. It's a discipline of recognizing and taking responsibility for the impact our actions have on other people, because they do, even indirectly. You know, if you know, Simon Sinek tells this story that I just love. He and a friend are walking down the street talking, and a few yards in front of them, the person has a backpack that has split open and papers are falling out of it. And so as they're talking, without even thinking, they sort of reach down, they pick up those papers as they're going, they catch up with the guy and say, here, these fell out of your backpack, be careful. The guy says, thank you. And they go on like nothing happened. And at the next signal, they're waiting for the light to change. And somebody says to them, hey, I saw what you did for that guy. That was really cool. Is it that unusual that somebody would act that way? I see somebody's having a problem. I'm in a position to help with very little effort, and this is a novelty that I would put myself out. for that person? It's a little scary.
Well, I bring it down to, and you know, we'll wrap this up, but I bring it down to, we don't teach people how to hold a door for anybody anymore. If we taught our children today to hold the door open for somebody, man or woman, doesn't matter, old, young, whoever, you hold the door open. It's not the fact that you're holding the door for them. You're teaching them to help somebody else from a very young age. And that, you know, that's what we do for each other. We work together. And, you know, does not make me any less to do something for you. And I think that our society needs to get back to that, where we truly are interdependent and our lives are truly better when we work together and ego gets taken out of the equation and common goals come back to, you know, to front and center.
Yeah, I actually have a book titled Fix Your Broken Windows. And it's based on the theory that they applied in New York City, that if you have a neighborhood with broken windows and boarded up doors and graffiti and derelict cars, it's going to attract crime. And if you clean up the neighborhood and make it look respectable, then the crime rate is going to fall. And, you know, there's a certain amount of evidence that it worked. It was somewhat controversial, but the principle is sound. When you see order and structure and things working the way they're supposed to be, there's a certain pressure to fit in and to raise your own standards. And such simple things, I use it, hold the door. You know, let a car pull out into traffic in front of you. When you're walking down the street, make eye contact with a pedestrian going the other way. Smile. Say good morning. Okay, if you're walking the streets of Manhattan, it's a little more complicated.
But imagine if you actually got people to smile back.
Yeah, I mean, it feels good to smile. So you get a smile in return. When you smile at somebody else, they smile back. You get smiled at, you feel better, they feel better. What did it cost? Just the awareness of doing something that we really should do without thinking.
I love it. You know, we could talk for hours. I mean, I'm sure after this conversation, you and I will, you know, have many conversations beyond this, and I will make sure people have access to your TED Talk, that they can know where they can buy your books, you know, and they know how to get in touch with you. That we'll put all that in the show notes. So if you haven't sent me that information, send it to me so we can make sure we can share it with everybody. But I have one question for you, and we'll take it as you come off a stage, because you and I are keynote speakers. We, you know, get in our car and we drive away. What's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
Think about me?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. When I gave my TED Talk, I told the story of when I got to Israel and I got trapped in a room with a Hasidic rabbi. I wanted to escape. I couldn't get out. There were too many people blocking the way. So I had to listen to him. And he started talking and I said, how is it possible that somebody who looks like that sounds like this? He was so articulate and so rational. I couldn't reconcile that stereotype. And that forced me to reconsider my stereotypes. And that's what ended up changing my whole worldview and the whole course of my life. Well, I finished giving the TED Talk. I went out the back off stage. I came, circled around, was going back into the auditorium, and a woman intercepted me. And she said, you know, when you got up on that stage, I knew exactly what kind of person you were. And I knew exactly what kind of talk you were going to give. And you shattered my expectations. You blew them away. She said, thank you. So this is really coming full circle. But what I like to do, because I look like a rabbi, we're only audio here, so people can't see, but people look at me and they automatically will make assumptions about what kind of person I am. And when they start hearing me, I hope that they reconsider those stereotypes, those assumptions. Because when we do that, then we start to train ourselves to look deeper, to think deeper, to give people a chance, to hear people out, people that we think are not, they have nothing to offer us. They have nothing to tell us, nothing to teach us, nothing we can gain from. It's almost never true. And as we were talking about earlier, if we listen to understand, then that brings us all closer together. And that creates a more ethical society and a better world. And when we create a better world, we get to live in that better world.
One of the most profound answers I've heard in a long time. So, Yonasan, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for your energy and your passion. I have enjoyed this talk immensely.
Well, it's been my pleasure as well. Thanks for having me on, Ben.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?